Well, as I said, we're just a few breaths away from New Year's and making all of those new old promises that we make to ourselves, promises that are based upon what we believe needs to change in us, behaviors that need to change that will hopefully make our lives better. Whether it's to stop smoking or to eat more or to exercise, whatever it is, those promises that we make to ourselves and even announce to others, that life would be different for us. This past week, I came across some tweets, and they're tweets by Bible characters. And the changes that they would make in this coming new year. Adam and Eve tweeted, "In this new year, we're going to give up fruit." Lot's wife, "In this new year, I will stop looking behind." Ezekiel, "This year, I will remember that books are for reading and not for eating." Hosea, "I will get her to love me this year. I can feel it." Peter, "I will stop asking, what about John?" Thomas, "I will stop missing important meetings." Ananias and Sapphira, "This year we will stop being so cheap." The author of Hebrews, "In the new year, I will stop forgetting to sign my name on important documents." Many of us will make those usual common promises, like I said, that we're going to exercise more and we're going to eat less, or we're going to learn how to play a new instrument, or how to speak a new language. The ones we hear commonly, the ones we struggle with. But sadly, there are promises made in the new year that aren't the positive ones. In fact, January is considered the month of divorce. Lawyers will tell you that January is the number one month that people file for divorce, and it continues right up to about March. People file for divorce in January because, in their minds, it's a way to start the new year right. It's a way to start it fresh. It's a way to get rid of the old and bring in the new. Others do it because they want to wait till after Christmas so that they don't ruin Christmas for their kids. Others wait till January because of the potential tax breaks that could come one way or the other. Some look at it as a way of kind of stowing away company bonuses that they won't have to share. And others do it just because they want to get past the bills of Christmas before they jump into lawyer bills. According to Divorce Magazine, which is such a sad thing that there's actually a magazine called Divorce Magazine. But anyways, according to Divorce Magazine, divorce has actually gone down a little bit. It used to be 50%. It's now about one-third of marriages will end in divorce. This morning, we're going to continue our study on looking at the impact of culture on the church. And we're going to look at the impact of the culture of divorce on the church, because it's had a huge impact. It affects the life of the church. It affects the families of the church. It affects the pain of children. It affects the way that people view the scriptures. In fact, it's such an issue that even the Apostle Paul took it up in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And so as we continue this study, we're going to look at the issue. As Paul shares with us in 1 Corinthians 7, and as we kind of bounce back and forth from some other key passages of scripture that deal with divorce, because divorce is a major issue. In this room, probably half of the people here, in one way or another, have been impacted by divorce. We have seen people lose homes. We have seen people lose retirements. We have seen people fall behind and never catch up. And we have seen people come to church every Sunday in tears because of the losses that they've suffered. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians 7, which is a passage that is not just about divorce, but it focuses on a key question. What about divorce for believers? What about divorce for believers who are married to non-believers? Is it okay to divorce somebody because they're a non-believer? Now, as we look at the issue, we're going to kind of expand it because Paul's words really call for us to look beyond just what's being written in 1 Corinthians 7. But as we do this, I want you to listen. And I understand for some people here this morning, this could be painful. This could dredge up old memories, or it could dredge up old guilt or present guilt. And I want you to just put it behind. Because the scriptures are there to correct us, they're also there to encourage us. And I will make sure that as we come to the end of that, we'll see both. And so I'm going to ask you to open up your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And we're going to begin in verse 10. Paul says, "To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, and a husband must not separate, excuse me, I'll get it right. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband." Now, it's a command. And notice he says, "not I, but the Lord," because it goes back to the very words that Jesus spoke in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus wrote, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Jesus is the one who gave the command. In the Old Testament, there was the right to divorce, but you had to give a certificate of divorce. And a certificate of divorce meant that the woman who was now sent on her own, it was usually men divorcing women in the Old Testament, because they're the ones who maintained all of the assets. And so you got to understand, in the Old Testament and right up to Jesus' day, when divorce took place, it was really a man kicking a woman out, kicking her out on the streets with no support. And in those days, oftentimes, their families wouldn't take them back. And so you had women struggling to live on their own on the streets. And a woman living on her own in the streets during these times were usually viewed as women who were prostitutes. And so they were given certificates of divorce to show that they were not women of the night, but that they were legitimate women who had been divorced, but who had been thrown out by their husbands. Jesus gives the command and says, "You can't do this." In fact, he locks it down pretty tightly. He says, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So Jesus was saying, no, you don't just get to do that anymore. I'm telling you this, and I'm commanding you. You don't get to just put away your wife. You don't just get to give her a certificate and provide her with meager support. I tell you, if you do it, that you're committing adultery and you're causing her to commit adultery. Now notice, he makes an exception. He gives a concession. And the exception in the concession is this: except for adultery. Jesus was saying, this is my command, except if a spouse has committed adultery. It's interesting that when you look at marriage, it is very much a physical covenant between a man and a woman. And so when adultery takes place, it is stepping outside of that physical covenant and it is breaking it. Go back to 1 Corinthians. Paul says this, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. Now, Paul is giving a concession. He's saying, if she does separate from her wife, from her husband, she must remain unmarried. Now remember, Paul is talking about those people who are married and who are married to unbelievers. Because the question was this, if I become a believer and my spouse doesn't become a believer, isn't that reason enough to leave? And we've seen the tension and the pain that comes with that, with people who come to Christ and their spouse doesn't. People who have every Sunday morning been used to getting up early and just running off to the beach, or every night filling their time with worldly activities, and all of a sudden someone accepts Christ as their Savior and says, no, on Sunday mornings I want to go to worship. I want to go and worship God. I want to be in fellowship with others. This is what God would have me to do. And I'd like to be part of a Bible study so that I can grow in my faith. Now, there are some non-believing husbands, non-believing wives, who are okay with that, who even see that as a way of making a better spouse for themselves. But there are many, many more who are not okay with that. I know spouses who have struggled with spouses because they get angry that, you know, we could be getting a fresh start off to the beach early in the morning, and yet you want to go to church. Or we're struggling enough with our finances, and you want to talk about tithing, giving 10% of our money to the church? What, are you crazy? We're not going to do that. No, you're not going to go out on a Tuesday night to a Bible study. You're supposed to be home, taking care of the family and being with me. All the tension that you hear about and that you've seen, that you've had friends tell you about. Paul says to them, no, if you become a believer, that's not reason for you to just cut out and leave a spouse. He goes on and says, to the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. And what he's saying is this, not that this isn't a command of God. He's saying that this wasn't a command that was spoken in Jesus' ministry, and yet it was one that was revealed to him. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and is willing to live with him, she must not divorce him. Now, why is that? The goal is this, even though they're not believers, you have an opportunity. You probably, of all people, have the best opportunity to win them to Christ. Listen to what Peter says in 1 Peter 3. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Peter's saying this, even if you're married to an unbeliever, if you live out your faith, if you live out what you've been taught to live out in relationship to your spouse, you have a great chance of winning them. If you live in such a way that you honor them, that you show respect to them, that you're not nagging them and fighting them to go to church with you, or just nagging them about their pagan behaviors, but if you just live in quiet submission That's about the best way you can win them to the faith. And I've seen spouses do that. I've seen spouses push their spouses away from the faith because of the nagging and the judgment that they've placed upon them. It's interesting when we think about this command not to divorce. Why do people today divorce? Number one reason is usually sexual affairs, people going out and committing adultery. Or the big thing you see going on today, emotional affairs, people getting on the internet and talking to other people. Or one of the big things is flirting. You see men and women in the office place flirting with coworkers or flirting with bosses and get entangled in dependent relationships where now all of a sudden they're causing their spouses to become jealous or to doubt what's going on. Mental illness. People with mental illness have, depending on the mental illness, anywhere between 18% to 90% higher rates of divorce. Usually among people who won't treat it, but even still, it becomes a burden that people can't live with, and they often just walk away from the marriage because they become so frustrated with the ups and downs. Unrealistic expectations. People enter into marriage with the expectations of what their spouse is going to do for them, not what they're going to do for their spouse. And so they look and they realize, my spouse has not lived up to my expectations, to the things that I believed were just basic for a marriage. And so now they begin to feel disappointed. They begin to feel ripped off. They begin to feel bitter, and they begin to demonize each other. Couples that argue with each other all the time. 75% of divorces happen with couples that just keep arguing every single day. Financial pressures. And we know that. People fight over money because money represents security, money represents power and position within a marriage. Money represents even our own preconceived ideas of what a good spouse is. And lastly, work pressures, especially today where we've got men and women both working, both maintaining their own careers, and one not being there for the other when they get home. One not being there for the kids when they get home. It tears marriages apart if there's not a sense of priority. And the impact of it, we see all the time. In marriages that have divorced, you see the lack of esteem among spouses. When I counsel spouses who have been divorced, there's always this sense of failure that they carry with them, that they have somehow let down their spouse, or they've let down God. And for many of them, the victims who haven't done anything to let down anyone still walk around feeling like they failed God because of the divorce. The impact that it has on kids, the insecurity that kids grow up with, the insecurity of struggling with knowing that people aren't permanent, that people who say they love you and they care about you could be gone tomorrow. And so as they even approach their own marriages, they enter into it with a skepticism of whether their spouse will be there 10 years from now. The impact of guilt. I remember I was with a friend of mine, and we were at a barbecue, and it was a party for his engagement party. And I remember just going with standing next to him as a grill as he was flipping burgers, and his fiance was probably 20 feet away. And out of nowhere, he said to me, I should have stayed with Susan. And I thought, Bubba, now ain't the time for that. But he was just reflecting on all the damage to his kids and all the things that couldn't be undone. And even though he loved this woman, he knew it'll never be what it could have been. The impact of bad decisions. People who get divorced oftentimes will go on and make bad decisions, bad financial decisions, bad relational decisions. It's amazing how many people will go out and marry the exact same person with the exact same problems and flaws that they just left, and they said, I'll never do that again. I was young and stupid, but now that'll never happen. And in the end, all we find is young went away, but stupid remained. And they continue the same stuff they were continuing before. The financial losses. In divorces, men will usually, over time, move beyond their losses. Women won't. In fact, I was talking to a gentleman recently whose wife is divorcing him. And yet when they sat down with the mediator had put together a graph that showed that over time, he recovers and starts to move forward, but she stays about plateau. Now, that's not for everyone. But for one or the other, there is going to be a financial loss because money that was pulled together now gets ripped apart. Jesus made it a command because he understood the damage and the impact that it has. The damage and the impact that it has on the church. The ministries that now people aren't qualified for just because of the qualifications that are required for certain ministries. And yet, there's a concession. The concession is, but if she does leave, if he does leave, they must remain unmarried. Now, why would you give such a concession like that? Because there are times when separation is a valid consideration. If you're in a marriage where there's abuse and you're putting up with that every single day, it's not God's will for you to be kicked around. Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before a swine. Don't feed what's sacred to dogs. We're not to be treated as doormats to be walked upon. If you're in a relationship where your spouse is taking every dollar that you have and spending it on alcohol or using it on drugs or spending time just watching pornography, and there are times to separate. There are times when you've done everything you can do that you separate. That's not divorce. You don't get to go out and remarry. Because the idea is that you're hoping that something will happen, that something will shift. And in that time, if the other person doesn't shift and the other person decides that they're going to go off and remarry, well, as we're going to see, Paul would say, then you're free. If you're married to an unbeliever who just is abusive and you have to separate, and then afterwards they decide they're going to find someone else, you're free. But separation is only a consideration when you're looking to try to bring about change. So you say, where's the biblical support for that? Let me show you a couple of passages. Primarily, 1 Timothy chapter 5. Anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Anyone who does not take care of their immediate family. And to me, this is the person who goes off and he just blows all the money on alcohol. Or the person who is putting the family in jeopardy because of drugs, or because they're blowing the money, they can't pay the rent, and now they're living in cars, and I've seen that. Or people engaging and looking at pornography, other demon, and it comes a point when you say, this has got to stop. This is killing everyone. Paul would say this, if you're going to engage in that and not stop, then you've denied the faith and you're worse than an unbeliever. And if they won't stop, that's where Matthew 18 also comes in. In Matthew 18, we're told that if someone sins against us, that we go to them. And if they won't hear us, we bring another person. And if they still won't hear us, we bring it before the church. And if they still refuse to hear it, then they're declared an unbeliever. And so the separation then is allowed to become divorce, because the body of Christ has determined this person is an unbeliever. And the way that they're living with you, they've already left you. They're just using you. They're there to live off your money. They're there to live off your labor, but they're contributing nothing. They're taking care of no one. They're living worse than even the pagans live. But that's something that has to be declared through Matthew 18 within the church. Now, I know people who say, well, how can that be? My husband won't go to church. And yeah, there are times that a pastor or elders will come together and say, you've done everything you possibly can. But listen to what Paul goes on to say. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else reconcile to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife. And the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Now, what does that mean, sanctify? It means this, that they participate in the same blessings of the believer. Because when you live in a home with a believer in that home, they bring blessings to that home that aren't there for a non-believer. Because as they're praying for change, as they're praying for financial circumstances, as they're praying for healing, their spouses benefit from that. And in that process, as they hear the word of God, as they see the Bible, as they come to a service with their spouse, more and more, they are being set apart to be able to hear and have a better chance to make a decision. In fact, Paul says, and this is part of the logic of Paul's reasoning, otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. And part of that, he's saying, yeah, if you just leave, then what are you saying about your kids? You're saying that they never had a father, that they never had a mother. You're discounting what took place in that holy union. And so Paul is giving the concessions, but in the midst of it, he's also giving the reasoning for staying together. And the reasoning is this: look, you have a great opportunity to win your spouse. God's Spirit is working in you, and therefore God's Spirit is working in that home. And secondly, you've got to think about what you're doing to your children, putting them out there to live as people who come from a family that isn't a family anymore. Now, in our world today, that doesn't feel like a big deal because everybody's doing it. And yet, trust me, your kids will feel different. I remember one day I was picking up one of my kids from school, and I won't say which one. It was a female one, so you can, I remember Katie said to me, she said, "In tears, are you and Mom getting divorced?" And I was like, "Where are you getting that from?" And she said to me, "All my friends, their parents are divorced." And I thought about that. All of my friends. what it feels like to come from a family that's no longer a family. Paul goes on and says, but if the believer leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? As much as we are called to fight and labor to keep a marriage together, there are times we can't. There are times that they just leave. There are times that they choose to go their own way, and there's nothing we can do about it. And Paul says, it's okay. If you're in that situation, then no, you've done nothing wrong. Because God would have you live in peace. So how do we deal with this? Because some of you are dealing with it now. Some of you are looking forward to getting married one day. And you better be weighing this stuff out. Some of you are sitting here divorced and remarried. Let me give you just four things to think about. First of all, trouble is easy in and hard out. Trouble is easy in and hard out. If you're going to get married, you had better think and pray and do your work. I love what James Dobson says. Before marriage, eyes wide open. After marriage, half shut. But before marriage, you better have your eyes wide open. If your parents say to you, I'm telling you, this is not the right person for you. This person has problems. This person has all sorts of issues. They don't have character. Don't fall into the trap of saying, my parents don't know them. They don't know what they're talking about. They're old and crazy, and I know it's right. Because many a person has sat in my office and said, I should have listened to my mother. I should have listened to my father. I should have listened to my friends. Trouble is always easy in, and it's always hard out. And so before you get married, you better consider everything. And you bring them to me. You insist we are going to do marital counseling. And it's not a done deal until it's done. Because as much as I think I love you, that's not enough. I have to know whether you're right for me. Because you don't win people to Christ with dating evangelism. I'll just marry them, and my wonderful will be too strong for them to overcome, and they will come to Christ and go to church, and we'll live. That doesn't happen. Trouble in is easy, and trouble out is hard. Number two, things can change. People can change. Circumstances can change. One of my greatest joys is when I have marriages that come in that, I mean, they are broken in so many pieces. You know, most therapists hate doing marital therapy. Because it is filled with so much strife and heartache and pain. And I love doing it because I love to see what can happen. when people are willing to do whatever it takes. And yes, sometimes that means what I call eating glass. Sometimes that means you do what is painful and uncomfortable and out of your comfort zone, but you recognize, I have got to change. This is not working. Whatever it takes for me to do, I will do. Because I owe it to the person I made a promise to. I owe it to my children. I owe it to God. The die is never cast unless you believe it's cast and can never be broken. Number three, separation over divorce always. Don't just run to divorce. We're lucky in New Hampshire, if you can say it like that, but in New Hampshire, we have laws for separation. Other states don't. Massachusetts, you just divorce, that's it. In New Hampshire, we have legal separation. Legal separation allows you to part because you're trying to protect your family, you're trying to protect assets that that person might be spending or whatever, and yet you're not denying the marriage. You're not denying that you're married. You understand that you can't remarry. The whole idea is for some financial protection and some distance for you guys to work it back together and bring it back together. Now, just word for the wise, if you ever meet with an attorney, they'll say to you, you don't want to do that. It's too expensive. Because if it doesn't work out, then you got to go back to court and file for divorce, and that's going to cost you more money. It's just more expedient to go with the divorce first. Well, sometimes that happens. And oftentimes you want to judge whether a spouse really wants to work on something. You file for separation, they'll say, I don't love you that much. We're going for divorce. But always separation over divorce. Notice Paul says, if it has to be, yeah, you can separate. That's the concession. But the idea is to come back together again. Number four, and this is important. There's nothing that is unforgivable. There is nothing that is unforgivable. Divorce is not the great deadly sin. It's awful. It's painful. It's not usually the sign of two evil people. It's usually the sign of two hurting, lost people who can't find their way back together. But it's not unforgivable. God doesn't put you aside and say, well, you can come to heaven, but we have a little corner for you people. Not the case. It is no different than any other sin. Because every sin has its consequences. The problem with divorce is it impacts not you, but it impacts the people around you. It impacts a promise and a covenant you made. But it is not unforgivable. God allows us to pick up our lives and to move forward and to seek second chances. Because the God we worship is a God of second and third and fourth and fifth chances. There was a Scottish preacher who was preaching throughout Scotland and just receiving all sorts of opposition and was being mocked, and people were throwing alcohol bottles at him when he would come to town to preach. And one day one man asked him, how are you able to carry on in the midst of such opposition, in the midst of such hostility? And he said to them, it's because I have a happy home. You can face anything in the world if things are right at home. And so do everything you can. Everything you can to make things right at home. Your job is not more important than your marriage. Your personal needs or wants or desires are not more important than your marriage. Your self-esteem or your ambitions are not more important than your marriage. It is God first and it is spouse second. And marriage takes a lot of work. And if you don't do it, you'll create a lot of misery. Why does Paul call husbands to love wives like the church and wives to submit to their husbands? It's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that works. I'm not going to have some man telling me what to do. No, Paul wasn't saying that. It's respect, it's honor. It's putting the person first and treating them as a best friend. And yeah, it's a willingness to die for the other. It's the willingness to put yourself out. It's the willingness to be a provider and a protector. But it only comes when people are willing to put the marriage above everything else. You put your bank account, you put your job, you put your friends, you put your family above your marriage, and all you will do is cause yourself and everyone around you misery. And yet, if you do it the way God has called you to do it, you will be blessed. You will help in the sanctification of your spouse and of your children. And you will leave a legacy. I sit with too many people. And when I'm counseling with them, the first thing I do is I try to get history from them. I ask them, tell me about your mother. Tell me about your father. Tell me about their marriage. How was their marriage? I bet you 75% say it wasn't good. All they did was fight. All there was tension and anger in our home. Imagine that. Doesn't have to be that way. If you can shore up your marriage and shore up your family, then whatever happens out there, piece of cake. You know what stressed spells backwards? Desserts. You can make the stress of the world out there a piece of cake if you change what goes on inside. Let's join our hearts in prayer.